Hi, this is Elmore Leonard. I'm listening to Film Sociology, and it's a real program. It's great.
It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplex and the art house. What's new on video and streaming, and you might also hear about some dead people we like.
We don't have time for dead people we don't like.
Anyway, this is Film Sociology, where you'll find out what's the next cinematic marvel.
It was unbelievable!
And what's just a movie.
Shut up! My God, you have no freaking life!
Okay, here's your host and my dad, Matthew Soucy.
Hello there, film lovers. Welcome to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on Twitter, at Matthew Soucy. This show is available on iTunes, and like all of the podcasts here at WFYI, available on Spotify. Busy show this week, friends. First and foremost, Indie Film Fest. It's happening. It is happening in person. It is happening online. And it is happening June 15th through the 26th. 15th through the 19th at the Can-Can, and online screenings continuing through June 26th. You can go to indiefilmfest.org for all the tickets and information. Don't miss Indie Film Fest. Because you're film fans, you should check that out. Once again, indiefilmfest.org, running June 15th through the 19th at the Can-Can Cinema, and running through June 26th with online screenings. indiefilmfest.org. Now, it's already out, but still running through June 15th, so as soon as the festival begins, is a documentary I was really, really looking forward to, and it did not disappoint. Jazz Fest, A New Orleans Story. This is out by Sony Classics, and it's kind of riding the wave of Summer of Soul as far as telling a very important music story with lots of great music. So talks about the history of the festival. It's now 50-plus years. Of course, 2 years were canceled because of COVID. What this one does, and I think there will be comparisons to Summer of Soul as far as the music presentation and the storytelling, there are way more talking heads, lowercase t, lowercase h, in this one. Everybody from Jimmy Buffett to Katy Perry to Bruce Springsteen. And this also brings up an aspect of festivals that I just want to address a little bit. It has become known as the Jazz and Heritage Festival, I believe, down in New Orleans, because you have more than jazz artists performing there. What is the great history of this festival over the years is if you're a popular enough act and you get booked at Jazz Fest in New Orleans, you're doing fine. This was created by George Wein, who had done the Newport Jazz Festival and the Newport Folk Festival, and they wanted to make something down in New Orleans, which obviously when it first started, all local musicians and local jazz musicians, but then they started bringing in other folks. They started bringing in other styles. There was blues artists, there were soul artists, gospel artists. That is all covered here at the festival. Great footage of Preservation Hall. And we also get a little bit of the culture. We get looks at the jazz funeral, the food that happens over there, Cajun culture, Zydeco culture, the gospel tent, world music, the feeling of acceptance, because there's such a diverse, not just a diverse crowd of people, but a diverse a variety of music at the festival. Other talking heads include Irma Thomas, Pitbull, yeah. I forgot to mention Jimmy Buffett's one of the executive producers on this, so that kind of goes without saying. It does, and probably within the last 10 minutes of the film, they do address Katrina and what happened there. But and also the Marsalis family. I don't want to miss the Marsalis family. This is a really, if you enjoyed Summer of Soul, you're gonna really dig Jazz Fest, A New Orleans Story. It's one of those. As soon as you see it, you think, man, I gotta get down there, and I do. I need to work on that. It's just kind of at times a magical experience from the recordings I have heard and seen I'm hoping there is a, well, there is another documentary about New Orleans called Take Me to the River. I don't want to forget that. But I am hoping that there is a soundtrack that goes with Jazz Fest, some of which I can play on the other program on the weekends. The others, that's okay. But no, this, so the, yeah, the diversity of the Jazz Festival lineup, I think, is something important because I, over the years, I have made fun of certain blues fests that have all either all white artists, which I've emceed, or they don't have any blues artists at all, and they're just using it as a brand name. Apparently, the Jazz Fest in New Orleans, this doesn't bother me as much as some especially some festivals up in Canada where, well, I've shown those posters on social media. So anyway, long story longer. Yeah, if you're a fan of music, check out Jazz Fest, a New Orleans story. It is running at the Can-Can through June 15th. And then, of course, the film festival starts up, the 19th Indie Film Fest, happening at the Can-Can, the 15th through the 19th, and then online screenings running the 15th through the 26th. Okay, let's shift gears a little bit. Let's find out what's playing at the drive-ins and some other places. We'll get to a movie that I got to watch on video, a very fun chat with Patty Glenn, and then we'll grab a pencil and find out what you've been watching. We go to the Tibbs Drive-In, and on screen one, just Jurassic World Dominion. So if you want to watch it twice, there you go. Screen 2, Top Gun Maverick, and Raiders of the Lost Ark. That's pretty good. And not Indiana Jones and the Raiders of the Lost Ark for you home video promotional folk. Screen 3, The Bad Guys and Jurassic World Dominion. Ooh. And screen 4, Bob's Burgers and Crimes of the Future. Okay, have fun with that. That's happening over at the Tibbs Drive-In. Over at the Skyline this weekend, Jurassic World Dominion and The Mummy is running through the 12th. Jurassic World Dominion on the 16th. And then next weekend, 17th, 18th, and 19th, Jurassic World Dominion with the original Tremors. So I always like to see old titles at the drive-in. Well done. That's over at the Skyline Drive-In in Shelbyville. At the Historic Art Craft Theater in Franklin, Friday and Saturday, 2 and 7:30 p.m., June 10th and 11th, The Sandlot. Tuesday, June 14th at 10 a.m., Spirit, Stallion of the Cimarron. Tuesday, June 21st at 10 a.m., so as part of the Summer Break Series, Hotel Transylvania. And then June 24th and 25th, Friday and Saturday, 2 and 7:30 p.m., from 1972, What's Up, Doc? All of that is happening over at the Historic Art Craft Theater in Franklin. As I mentioned, at the Can-Can, Crimes of the Future is running, as is Jazz Fest. Jazz Fest and Everything Everywhere All at Once are running through the 15th before the festival, so make a note of that over at the Can-Can. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. One video I was able to watch, because next week I will talk at a little more length about the Werner Herzog box set that I received recently. All right, I bought it. But From Russia, courtesy of Wellgo USA Entertainment, is a horror film called Row 19. And it's set during an overnight flight with very few people on it. And we find out at the beginning of what is a flashback, and it's one of those films that, first off, thankfully, under 80 minutes, it moves. So there's that aspect, and we don't have that many characters to introduce ourselves to. We have a young woman who survived a plane crash as a child. She is now old enough to be a mom with her own little girl with her on a flight. We have an older couple of which the wife is afraid to fly. We have a three-piece suit yuppie guy, well, three-piece suit guy who just wants to get home, who's making fun of the hippie who's constantly drawing and not making much communication. But we get this overnight flight, and it's one of those that over time we find out, is this a scary monster movie, you know, an invasion movie, or is this a flight that is terrorized by our own fears? I think you can take a guess from that. But as far as, again, quick, quick jumps and telling a story in a timely fashion, Row 19 works. So I recommend it if you have it come across your streaming. It's available digital Blu-ray and DVD. It's already out. So that's Row 19 from Wellgo USA Entertainment. Okay, we're going to shift gears again. And there were a couple of films a few weeks back that I got to experience for the first time in a long time. And what these two films have in common, it's a great excuse to bring up my buddy Patty Glenn, who runs a bookstore in Richmond, Indiana, co-runs it with her sister, to talk about these two films as well as what's going on at the Two Sisters Bookstore. So here's my chat with Patty Glenn. Enjoy. Joining me on Film Sociology is one I'm happy to say has become one of the usual suspects on this show. She is co-owner of the Two Sisters Bookstore in the Depot District in beautiful downtown Richmond, Indiana. She is also the Wayne County president of the Silence Film Fan Club. Patty Glenn is on the line. How are you, Patty?
I am great. That is quite an introduction.
That's not a real organization, because Patty always tells me, first it was stop telling my dad to watch Silence, then my family, and then just stop telling everybody to watch Silence. So I have you on, Patty, because, and by the way, if you want to see performance art, it's when I come visit Patty at the bookstore, because it will be a two-person show for at least an hour. It's a lot of fun. But I found a film that you've talked about at great praise, and one I had not seen, I think, from start to finish since it came out. But you said that Murder by Decree is your favorite Sherlock Holmes film of all time.
One of.
Sorry, I stand corrected. So I would say the floor is yours. Present not your argument, just present your praise.
All right. So brace yourselves, listeners. Sherlock Holmes is literally my favorite thing to talk about, and that just gave me a microphone. So.
Whatever.
The first thing that I absolutely love about the film actually doesn't have to do with Sherlock Holmes, but has to do with, like, crime fiction in general.
Okay.
And it's, there is an aspect of crime fiction that, like, we started way back with the ancient Greeks, with, of all things, Oedipus.
Wow.
And and the idea behind it is that, like, a crime occurs, and it's because an injustice has been committed that is so unjust, for want of a better word, that it literally pollutes society. And so you have to have this outsider who comes in and fixes it and restores balance. And, like, the Greeks called it a miasma. This film is, like, one of the few crime films I've seen that I don't think that's what they were going for, but they managed to, like, get that. Like, because you feel uneasy watching this film. It's a very wonderfully atmospheric film. I love that about it. The other thing that I really, really love is actually their Sherlock Holmes. One thing that we tend to like not have in a lot of post-World War II Sherlock Holmes adaptations is the concept that he's actually a pretty moral guy. His ethics are funky, but he's very moral.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, that is this Sherlock Holmes. I've never seen another person portray Sherlock Holmes in that manner before. Like, that whole scene at the end where he yells, well, British yells, so it's, like, sarcasm and, like, really, like, just a pointed tone.
Right.
Like,
curtly, yeah.
Curtly, yeah. He's very firm in his statements. at the politicians is, like, that is spot on Sherlock Holmes. Like, he does that in the books, and we tend to kind of not have that in a lot of adaptations, because I think modern people kind of are like, oh, moral characters are boring, and he's intelligent, so he should be this, you know, sociopath or something, and you're like, no, he's actually, you know, that's actually pretty accurate to the books. Plus, James Mason is just a wonderful Watson.
Yes.
All of that, and then James Mason.
Just let folks know, Christopher Plummer, so there's that Canadian training, yeah, plays Sherlock Holmes, yeah. And yeah, why does Watson sound like James Mason?
Yeah, no, he was a phenomenal General Watson. I actually would argue he's one of the best Watsons. He was great. I also think it's funny that, like, that film got made in 1979, and then there was, like, another Jack the Ripper movie made in that same year.
Time after time. Yes.
Which I think would be a wonderful, like, double-header feature film thing to do.
We'll work on that. Yeah. I got to watch Time After Time in my film genre class at the Ball State University. Thank you to Dr. Wes Gehring for showing it to us. It's Malcolm McDowell as H.G. Wells. He has a time machine, and he winds up having – it is stolen by Jack the Ripper, played by David Warner. And he goes – and he winds up in San Francisco, 1979. Wells strikes a relationship with Mary Steenburgen's character, and they wound up getting married in real life. There's Jack the Ripper in a disco because it's 1979. It's a lovely piece.
Amazing.
Yeah, it is. And also the fact that at that time, anytime you could get a Malcolm McDowell in a non-psychotic role, because that was kind of that became his pigeonhole, his kind of bread and butter. And he's lovely in this. And this one, I wanted to ask you before that, what was your history with the Sherlock? I mean, were you the I think we all kind of grew up in one way, shape or form with the Basil Rathbone, Nigel Bruce's, because those were on TV constantly.
I remember the very first one I ever watched, and it was The Scarlet Claw.
Okay.
And, like, I was, like, 8, maybe? And, yeah, we rented it from, my dad adores Basil Rathbone, quite rightly. and so he rented, I remember we went to the public library, and they had them, and we rented them on VHS tape. And I remember watching it, and I remember being absolutely terrified of, like, the Scarlet Claw itself, which is this, like, garden tool. And, like, to this day, I'm still uncomfortable around those garden tools. But then, like, I saw it later, and I was like, this is not as scary as I thought it was.
But you dig for a living.
Yeah, I know. But we use shovels.
That should be your signature tool. Just, you know, face your fear and confront it and make it the Scarlet Claw.
No. But yeah, so I watched those, and then I enjoyed them so much that my father had a copy of the complete Sherlock Holmes, Volume 1, which little me did not realize it said Volume 1.
Is this like First Annual?
You know, it's this fun little story where my parents returned home to discover that I had finished the book, which ended with the final problem. And I was, like, sobbing because I thought Sherlock Holmes was dead.
Oh, jeez.
Like, my mom had to take me out to the library and get me Volume 2. So that, like, yeah.
I'm sorry, did you mean The Final Solution, or is that a different title, The Final Problem?
It's The Final Problem.
Okay, sorry.
The final solution of it is the Nazis.
Right. And, well, but that's because, well, as I'm looking through Wikipedia, thank you, Internet, that Murder by Decree is influenced by Jack the Ripper, The Final Solution. So I'm sorry, I didn't want to get the titles confused.
No, Jack the Ripper, The Final Solution was if I remember correctly, it's like a history book that some guy wrote where he was trying to prove who Jack the Ripper was.
And apparently they blamed the Masons. Not James Mason, the Freemasons.
The Freemasons, yes. That was a thing at the time. It is interesting that, like, in terms of Sherlock Holmes, Jack the Ripper is never mentioned in any of the Sherlock Holmes stories.
Right.
Which is weird, because, like, Conan Doyle's writing during that time period, and it's, like, why do you never mention this very, very, very important murder spree that's going on? But yeah, after side note. But after reading all the books and that sort of stuff, I then was PBS. They had all the Jeremy Brett ones, who is to this day my absolute favorite Sherlock Holmes.
Okay, all right.
And then it just kind of took off from there.
And I also remember around the time for me was in the early incarnations of HBO, they would often film stage productions. And there was Frank Langella playing Sherlock in the late 70s, early 80s.
I That sounds amazing.
I think this was like right after doing Disco Dracula with the, and what I mean by that, friends, the 1979 John Badham film, The Gentleman Who Gave Us Saturday Night Fever. So Dracula has feathered hair and an open shirt, and I think
it's a good Dracula.
It is a love story. It's the love story portion of Dracula compared to the others, and. And, you know, everyone's second favorite Van Helsing, played by Laurence Olivier. he got more money. Anyway, so that was happening around the time as well. So this film, 1979, is directed by Bob Clark, who is a cult cinema director, if there ever was one, although you see his films every year because he directed A Christmas Story, the original Black Christmas, the first Porky's. And if you look at his film career, it's quite eclectic of stories he gets to tell. And I remember watching this, and it's supposed to be almost a battle of the titans between Sherlock Holmes and Jack the Ripper. One of the things that Clark does is the wandering camera, which was already a staple in slasher movies by the late 70s. And it was, to a certain degree, a nod to his film Black Christmas, which is, I believe, the film that introduced us to the concept the call is coming from inside the house.
Really?
Yes. So you can thank / blame. And the original Black Christmas with Olivia Hussey and Andrea Martin and Margot Kidder and John Saxon, that's an underrated slasher film if you're into that sort of thing. But what was interesting about watching this film, it's got an all-star cast, and it was used very economically. It's like, we have so-and-so for a couple of days, and because there's Plumber and Mason, but then you have David Hemmings as Inspector Foxborough, Susan Clark is in this, Frank Finley, Anthony Quayle, Donald Sutherland, Jonvia Bougeau, John Gielgud, and none of them have scenes together, unless they're with Plumber or Mason. So it's like, okay, we got Sutherland for 2-3 days, let's shoot his stuff. It was very economical.
It is almost like a Muppet film cameo. It's real, but, you know, very serious. I remember watching this film and just being like, oh my gosh. People just kept popping up, and it's just this who's who of people.
Okay, because you mentioned it, Kermit's got to be Sherlock, Fozzie's got to be Watson.
Oh gosh, yeah.
And everybody else are humans.
Yeah. That was a wonderful mean thing that I saw online, that somebody sent me, that was the take any movie and replace all but one of the actors.
Correct.
With Muppets.
Yes.
Like, yeah, it's wonderful.
What is your favorite?
I think there was, it was the Pride and Prejudice.
Oh, God. Who do you keep? Colin?
Keep Mr. Darcy. All the rest are Muppets. There was one other one where I was like, yes, brilliant. But I forget what it was.
There are two that I have. And one that I have to thank my wife for bringing up. She... Because of the amount of classic literature that the Muppets appeared in, sometime my wife misspoke and said Muppet Glass Menagerie. So here you go. Yeah, this is easy. This is easy. So Amanda is Piggy. Piggy is Amanda. Fozzie's the gentleman caller. Janice is the daughter. Oh God. Or no. What? No. Lynn wanted Janice to be the daughter. I wanted Emma Watson to be the daughter. And then Kermit, of course, is Tom. So that's not bad. My other one is you keep Ralph Fiennes and Schindler's List.
Yep. So. That's the thing, is it's always best to keep like the absolutely dead serious actor.
Yeah. Total. So, all right, back to Murder by Decree for a moment. The other thing about this film, and I'm sorry, spoiler alert on a 1979 mystery thriller, this has one of the more somber endings in a Sherlock Holmes film. We're used to him, I guess, solving the case, and they sort of do that here.
So that's the other funny thing, is that, like, that again is... He that's a lot of the stories where he like is kind of like, yes, and this was the solution, and Watson just goes, okay, that's done. But yeah, it was like I said, like this is the very like the more moral variant of Sherlock Holmes. So like the ending is him kind of ranting at these politicians in the, you know, the British rant.
Curtly, yes.
Yeah, very curtly, explaining why it's a problem. But yeah, like it was, and then they did like that retrospective where they showed you the shots of the people with their names.
The curtain call kind of thing.
Yeah, which was interesting. Like that was, I don't think I've seen that done with a Sherlock Holmes film. So yeah, it was. I really like that film. I would argue that my favorite Sherlock Holmes film is actually probably Without a Clue.
Yes. For those, it's Michael Caine as Sherlock Holmes, Ben Kingsley as Watson, and it's the theory that Watson's really the brains behind the operation.
Yeah, and it's so funny. That film's hysterical. Although, if we're allowed to include animated films, it's hands down The Great Mouse Detective.
Sure, why not? It's your show. Your shop. It's your, you know, whatever.
I mean, I still have days. There's all sorts of other ones. We've got, you know, like Young Sherlock Holmes, which is a wonderful little film that I was randomly introduced to, which is like this weird mix of, because it's got Steven Spielberg and Christopher Columbus and Kathleen Kennedy working on it, and it had like the first fully CGI character in any movie ever, and it's done by the people who make Pixar later and that sort of stuff, and it's just this random little what if Sherlock Holmes were a kid.
So, well, what we've had now, and I'm surprised there hasn't been talk of a reboot, but will the next Sherlock Holmes be as swashbuckling as the last guy? That would be Robert Downey Jr.
I mean, maybe they've done everything from that to, you know, Sherlock Holmes in the 22nd century. So, like, why not? Sure, put him on a boat.
Another lowercase, yeah, like a low-key version of that. I don't know. We'll see. So, yeah, that's look for Murdered by Decree. The other one I had to bring up, because anytime Patty and I are chatting, we love to gently poke, and now we can call him Academy Award winner Sir Kenneth Branagh. Good on him. He still doesn't have as many as Emma, but, you know, it's a good start. But
he looked so happy.
Yes, he was very happy. So we like that. But another film that I had not seen from start to finish since I saw it when it came out in 1994, a film that I like to call Kenneth Branagh's Mary Shelley's Frankenstein.
Yes, that film.
And it's called that film for several reasons. One, It didn't do well when it came out. It's a bit much. This film has more camera tricks in it than any other Kenneth Branagh film, and this man made a 4-hour Hamlet. And there's also an aspect of it, well, it ended something in his personal life, and the plot point involving the actors playing the character played by the actors also has a disturbing point. Which we'll get to in a minute. Your thoughts on Kenneth Branagh's Mary Shelley's Frankenstein?
My thoughts are everybody gets one. I will grant Kenneth Branagh that was his film where I think every actor and director or whatever artist gets one film where you just kind of watch it and you're like, why did you do that? What was that? And I think that's his.
Yeah.
My kind of fun story with this is, like, I had saw it when I was in college and had that response, like, what was that? And then one of my friends, like, months later, texted me and said, hey, I found a movie by that Kenneth Branagh guy you like. And I was like, oh, really, which one? And he goes, Frankenstein. I was like, no! And I had to then spend like several weeks being like, okay, listen, watch another one of his, any of his.
Yeah, any of his. Yeah, Dead Again or Peter's Friends, anything.
Like, do not base your opinion on that film.
Oh, heavens no. No, he's right. At the time he made this, friends, he was coming off Henry V is the one that kind of put him on the map, at least here in the States. He's already known in the UK. Made Dead Again, which was a Hollywood picture, did decent, and then made Much Ado About Nothing, which really kind of elevated him as the art house darling. Him and Emma Thompson were the new art house English movie couple. And that got him to do Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, which I should correct myself. It made money, just not as much money as Bram Stoker's Dracula, because it was because of that. Coppola was a producer on this, and because of the success, they wanted to revamp the Universal horror stories. And this was Sir Ken's attempt. It was just kind of a mixed bag, I should say. I stand corrected.
It's very stylish.
And his hair is great. I mentioned Frank Langella's feathered hair as Sherlock Holmes. Yeah, you should see the mop Sir Ken is as Dr. Victor Frankenstein, who could, you know, when he's not trying to create life, is touring with some rock band from the 90s.
It was a choice. Like, there's a lot in that film that was a choice.
No shirt, feathered hair, flailing around in goo with Robert De Niro or his stunt double, I guess.
But yeah, that film was definitely a choice. But like I said, everybody gets one.
And this was it. And it
he went on, did all his things.
And then he wound up doing The Midwinter's Tale. Which is known as the Spinal Tap for the Shakespearean crowd, and then kind of doubled down and made Hamlet, which is for me a lot of fun for 4 hours.
When I watched it in college in class, like we watched the entirety of that movie, but we like had to break it up in between class periods. But I'm really enjoying the Hamlet, even though it's one of those films where like you watch it and then you never sit through it again because it's so long.
Hamlet is the only film that I ever bought tickets over the phone. And this is, what, 1997? And to borrow a joke from Dennis Miller, I'm not on the phone this long with friends contemplating suicide. And there were rock concerts. Lynn and I saw this in Chicago. There were rock concerts easier to get in and out of. I mean, people were jumping and claiming seats. And, you know, it was a big cheer when the lights went down. There was an intermission. You could have had lighters and beach balls and all that stuff with this, since it had Sir Ken and half the Screen Actors Guild involved.
He is a wizard at getting people to be in his films.
it's a nice trick to have, is, you know, people want to work with you. So, and speaking of which, in this cast, one of the last acting performances from Tom Hulce, who became a producer, Aidan Quinn, Ian Holm. If you could say John Cleese is the original Snape playing a professor in this film. It's a rare dramatic role from John Cleese.
Gosh, I forgot he was in that.
Yeah, very serious, very foreboding. And then Helena Bonham Carter, who plays Victor's cousin, and then, you know, literally has her heart ripped out, which is, I'll get to that moment in a little bit, does her best Elsa Lanchester, and then in real life, they became a couple.
Mm.
A lot of that. I'm sorry, you were going to talk about the heart rip?
Yes, no, because less said about the other part, the better. But yeah, no, the heart rip scene, that was, I can handle gore in films. I'm not a big fan of it. But the heart ripping scene was a particular level where you're just like, what can
yep.
I just see? Yeah, no, like, I remember when I watched it for the first time, like, I literally, like, after that scene happened, like, paused and got up and, like, made myself a cup of hot chocolate, processed this, and came back. Because it was just, I was not expecting that at all.
No. But you know what? He had money in the budget for special effects, so, of course, he said, why not?
Mm-hmm.
This was a period in the 90s where my buddy Laura Jansen and I, we were obsessed with finding, whenever possible, movie-themed pinball machines. There was a Mary Shelley's Frankenstein pinball machine. And I played it, and I liked it very much. And because it's the 90s, if you have to imagine. So there's the front screen itself with your score, and there's more digital readings now. And there would be a little 90s digital screen at the bottom of the front face. And as customary in pinball, if your last two numbers match the random numbers picked by the pinball machine, you got a free game. So in this time, they would come up with some effect, some logo, something to announce that, you know, what the matching numbers were. For the Mary Shelley's Frankenstein pinball game, the creature drives his fist into Helena Bonham's chest and pulls out a number.
Yeah, just no. I probably assumed that was the pinball people trying to, like, process.
I laughed so hard the first time I played that game and that happened, and I continued to keep playing it just so I could match numbers and see. So they used the most gruesome aspect in the film for a pinball machine. Way to go, guys.
I mean, I guess go big or go home, but yeah. Like, that is actually, like, that scene is really what I remember of that film. That and, as you say, Kenneth Branagh's hair. that was a thing.
And he worked with, and Robert De Niro was the creature. He you know, early on in the film, he does, like, I think he has three lines with an accent, and then he loses it because he's dead and then brought back to life. And his part is fine. You know, he got top billing. Although there's a lot of him, like, walking through the snow. It almost felt like Mary Shelley's Cape Fear, of the creature trying to get revenge on his creator, and sort of does to a certain degree. So, yeah. So that's... Go ahead.
I will tell you, though, the greatest slip-up of accent in movie, in my opinion, in movie history.
Uh-huh.
So have you heard of a film called Dead Seven?
Dead Seven? No. Remind me.
This is beautiful. It is a zombie, post-apocalyptic zombie west, sort of western film.
Let me see. I'm pulling it.
Written.
Oh my God! I'm seeing.
And starring.
Oh.
And starring Nick Carter of the Backstreet Boys.
No.
As well as, like, a whole bunch of other.
Yes, I just pulled up. Actually, he didn't direct it, but he wrote it.
Oh, he didn't direct it.
Co-wrote it.
He didn't write it. Okay.
But no, I know it's, well, here I popped up and I see Nick Carter and Joey Fatone. I'm like, no, you have mentioned this. You have mentioned this. This is
no, this film is amazing. this film is amazing. I love this film. They do this song at the end where, like, all of those guys who were in the boy bands that are in the film got together and, like, made this song for the end, and it is like distilled 90s as this song. But one of the jokes that my sister found about the movie commented that there are seven accents going on in this film, and five of them are from Howie D. alone. it was beautiful. That was my favorite, like, in movie history, my favorite, like, shifting of accents, because it is, like, every scene he uses a different one.
So we out Costner's Costner in Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves. So, God, Dead Seven. Yeah, I'm glad you watched it.
No, everyone should see it. It's wonderful.
Okay, so
the people who made Sharknado were involved in it too.
You said that out loud, so
yep. It's just so people know what they're getting into.
Okay, that's pretty good. That's a pretty good vantage point there. That's good.
Yeah, like, again, like when you introduce someone to Kenneth Branagh's Frankenstein, he mentioned the heart ripping scene first.
Yeah, okay, all right, fair enough.
Yeah, no, like, you always warn someone, because, and again, I think the other thing why it was so surprising is that, like, I cannot think of another scene in any other Kenneth Branagh film where he does something like that. He's usually a very safe
no, I guess not, but I think his Douglas Fairbanks impression at the end of Hamlet swinging with a rope, and you know he's almost the only thing missing is putting his hands on his hips and going ha ha.
Yeah, but that's art. Like that's just... I think he was wanting to experiment and like kind of went, well, never doing that again. And yeah, like it's completely unexpected for Kenneth Branagh. I think the closest I have seen is the in Death on the Nile. There's a bit where a body pops up in the big turny things, wheels.
Oh, okay. Yes, yes. Yeah. No, you're right.
Yeah, like that is probably the closest he has gotten to doing another like graphic scene.
And
even that was really tame.
The Ken Branagh WTF moment. So there's one. We got two. For number three, you could have Andy Garcia smoking a cigarette through his trach hole and dead again.
Yeah, that was a little weird. It was definitely the heart ripping thing. Was like the biggest, like, what are you okay? Concerned about your mental state there. Are you all right? Like,
yeah.
But then he seems to have gotten that out of his system and went back to doing Kenneth Branagh stuff.
So, since you brought it up, your thoughts on Death on the Nile?
I enjoyed it. I did like Murder on the Orient Express better.
Yep. I'm sorry, Death on the CGI Nile.
I definitely liked the Murder on the Orient Express better. I am a little biased towards liking Death on the Nile because it's one of my favorite of the Agatha Christie books.
Uh-huh.
I would absolutely, they announced that he's making another one, and they said it's one of Agatha Christie's, like, lesser known ones, and so I'm rooting for Murder in Baghdad or Murder in Mesopotamia.
Now wait a minute. Well, first off, Death on the Nile was my first Agatha Christie film I saw in the theaters, so I know the chronological order. That means he's got to do Death on or Evil Under the Sun.
Oh yes, I really, really like Murder in Mesopotamia.
Okay, all right.
It happens, I mean, again, it happens on an archaeological dig, so bias.
No, that's fine.
I have seen one adaptation where they did justice to, like, the region that they're in, and it's this beautiful thing. But it was one of those where as soon as they announced he was doing one that's, like, not one of the big ones, I thought to myself, ooh, come on, like, you can do this. You know, gorgeous vistas with this murder movie. Like, it would be great.
Okay.
But yeah, no, I did enjoy Death on the Nile, but like I said, I think Murder on the Orient Express is the better of the two.
Agreed. Now, if he keeps doing these little intros and outros like it's a James Bond film, this is going to push my argument for Helen Mirren to play Miss Marple. Sexy, older, red Ferrari. She can still garden and still make tea, but it's Helen Mirren as Miss Marple. Come on, friends, get on it. And I'm a terrible guy, so there's that. I'm speaking with Patty Glenn here on Film Sociology, one of the co-owners of the Two Sisters Bookstore in the Depot District in beautiful downtown Richmond, Indiana. How are things happening over at the Two Sisters?
Great. We're finally managing to for a while there we were having shipping issues getting new stock in because it was stuck at the Canadian border, but now they've all come in and kind of at once, but we're actually a little snapped, so we've got tons of new stuff, and yeah, we're about to put all that on the show.
Okay. Well, and we have to mention, because I think we're contractually emotionally obligated to bring this, and then she'll get mad at us if we don't. Your sister has her second book of her trilogy,
yes.
or Neverending Saga. Please plug your sister's book. We love you, Kate.
Oh, no, we do. We love you, Kate. No, my sister's book. So that is a steampunk fantasy novel. A history teacher from our world falls through a portal into steampunk fantasy world, and he joins up with this incredibly eccentric crew of airship pirates.
As one would do.
Yeah, as you do. It has been performed before the crown heads of Europe.
That means it was at Fringe in Edinburgh, Scotland. I know, I was one of the chaperones.
And I was just there.
That's right.
But then actually we've made the joke of casting that as a Muppet movie. It would be Martin. So it's The Misadventures of Martin Hathaway is the book. And so the main character, Martin, we argued would probably be Kermit. And then the actual human, the only human left in the cast would be whoever plays Basil.
That's good. That's very good.
Everyone else is a Muppet. It'd be amazing. So Kate has written two of the books. She's in the process of writing the third. And since we're going to give her a shout out, I'm also going to give the obligatory hey. I've been reading your draft and it ends on a cliffhanger. Come on.
Wow.
Please finish the book. They just bought a house. So.
Yes, they did. They did. And where can people get in contact with the Two Sisters bookstore?
So we are on 193 Fort Wayne Avenue here in Richmond, Indiana, where you can find my sister's books. And my shrine to Sherlock Holmes in the back of the room.
And who's a part of your shrine?
And Matt is actually here as a part of the shrine as Professor Moriarty.
Thank you. Well, now that we've run back to Sherlock Holmes, I want to say here on Film Sociology, it's sort of a Film Sociology exclusive. You are making your directing debut at the beginning of 2023.
I am. Yes, at the Richmond Civic Theater. They are nice enough or crazy enough to allow me to direct the play Miss Holmes, which is a play that the basis of which is what if Holmes and Watson were women back in the Victorian era. So that'll be in January of 2023.
So you can look at gorct.org for more information on that. There might be a cameo by a certain someone. You just have to wait and see.
Not Cumberbatch.
I'm cheaper. No, I mean the special guest is cheaper. So on top of everything else, Patty, what movies have you been watching recently that don't involve Sherlock Holmes and heart rippings?
I've been doing my other job, my archaeology job, so I actually have not been watching a lot of films lately, though I have been watching the Kenobi series.
Okay, and?
Oh, gosh, it's awesome. I absolutely love it. Whoever was in charge of casting Ewan McGregor way back when, deserves an award.
Yep.
They've done a phenomenal job with that show. Let's see, what else have I seen? Watched recently.
Well, while you're thinking of that reminded me of in the early stages of the internet, friends, I learned well, and this is where I've come up with the idea of I don't care what's in negotiations until I see a poster or a trailer, I don't care. And I'm also appreciating the point until I sit down in the theater, it goes dark and the movie starts, I don't care. Because I had two basement-dwelling friends in the 90s who almost came to blows because one was convinced and was trying to convince the other that Kenneth Branagh was going to play young Obi-Wan in the second trilogy. So, and look what happened. Everything's fine. Well, that's right, a Shakespeare. But it was, this is the same thing where Freddy versus Jason and Alien versus Predator had been in discussions in development hell for over a decade. And then, of the three rumors that happened, the Ewan McGregor as Obi-Wan definitely turned out the best.
Oh gosh, yes. No, he is absolutely phenomenal as this character. They're really fun. I will not spoil anything that happens in the TV series for people who are listening, but it is well done and people should check it out.
There you go. So, all right. So yeah. So you're free from digs for now.
Oh yes, yeah. At least as far as I'm aware.
Okay. So just I know it's kind of like a doctor on call. There's always a phone. You know. So make sure you always have your movie glasses and always pull your hair back when you're digging.
Yes.
So that's a reference to the art film The Dig. If you go see it, you'll see Pamela Anderson in glasses. And now that I'm mixing all the references, you'll just have to check it out for yourself.
It is a good film, too.
Yes,
really
it is. Patty, appreciate your time. And, you know, go on down to the Two Sisters and tell her. Oh, wait a minute. I remember. Didn't you have a, we won't name the person, but didn't you have a young 20-something customer Star Wars plane in your presence?
Yes, we did.
We'll end on this.
There's another one of our customers who's going through, one of our regulars who's going through all the old Star Wars novels. And while he was purchasing one, we had a, actually the guy was in his 30s.
Okay.
But yeah, 30-year-old guy come up and start like explaining Star Wars to me. Which, if you have not been in the Two Sisters, I have a little, like, cutout picture of Luke Skywalker behind the counter, and then I've got, like, a little statuette of Rey, like, above the counter.
Kind of a dead giveaway.
It's kind of a dead giveaway, but I do actually know what Star Wars is. Also, I'm, you know, a person living in America within the past, you know, since 1977. I know what Star Wars is. And, yeah, the guy starts explaining Star Wars to me and all this different stuff. And my sister and I have come up with a good response, which is from this point on, whenever somebody attempts to do that, to just respond with, oh, Star Wars, you mean the Space Wizard movie for kids? Yes.
Wow.
Yeah. Like, I adore Star Wars, but, like, chill.
Actually, that should
films.
That should be the subhead for the Two Sisters. ... Just chill.
Chill, please. It was very strange.
So next time you go to the Two Sisters, friends, just chill. Have a cup of tea, look around, and just chill.
Just chill.
Thank you, Patty.
Oh, thank you for having me.
There you go, my buddy Patty Glenn. You can go check out the Two Sisters Bookstore in the Depot District in beautiful downtown Richmond, Indiana. And yes, pick up her sister's books. It just makes life easier. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. All right, friends, grab a pencil. Let's find out what you've been watching lately. Hopefully you've been able to watch some films that are new, or at least new to you, as well as falling back on old favorites. We start on Facebook, last week's post, with Robert, who writes the Bob's Burgers movie, Teresa, who writes Incredibles 2, Anthony, who writes The Guilty, and I'm Thinking of Ending Things. Jed writes, watched The Big Sleep, 1946, with Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall for the first time. Really enjoyed it. Highly recommended. Jed just tickles me. Jed Bryan, of course, is a guest. He's been on the show before as a filmmaker. His film Unlisted Owner, I believe we talked about that, but he has been really, really solid about trying new films and trying out, new to him films, as well as going beyond the horror genre. So thank you, Jed. I really, really appreciate your work and being a part of this program, and all of you for always submitting your stuff for me. I think that's very cool. Martin writes old, and there's a little back and forth between Martin and Gary. I appreciate that. Doug writes The Corn is Green, Lust in the Dust, Everything Everywhere All at Once, and What's Available for Stranger Things this season. Nick Rogers writes Hold Your Fire, Top Gun Maverick again. Navalny, The Bad Guys, Crimes of the Future, Jurassic World Dominion, and Alien Private Eye. Gary writes Analog Love, Jungle Cruise, The Jungle Book, both versions, Shang-Chi and the Legend of the Ten Rings, Jack and Jill, Jack the Ripper, 1976, Jackson Bolt, Sorceress, Abbott and Costello and Africa Screams, and Doctor Strange. Eric writes documentary about Harry Chapin and The Revenant, First Viewing. Lou Harry writes, Dishonored Lady, I love my dad. It happened one weekend. Leftover Feelings, a Studio B arrival. Jack Has a Plan, Bootyology, and Reopening. Chastity writes, Begin Again. Love Begin Again. We Are Lost Stars. Jared writes, The Grand Budapest Hotel and the latest Harry Potter film. Can't recall the name of it. That's okay. As the AV Club once called it, Wizards and Stuff. Only they didn't use stuff. Mark writes, The Last Waltz. And, well, there's a little bit back and forth as far as what about Robbie Robertson and the songwriting. Anyway, Dustin writes, Top Gun Maverick. Melissa writes, Jurassic World and Lightyear. JJ writes, Clash of the Titans, the original, the reboot of West Side Story, and Diner. I'm really glad you got to see Diner, JJ. I don't know if that's your first time watching it or not, but I remember watching it in the theater with my dad. I was 12, 13, and yeah, that's one of the more quotable films in my vernacular, in my film quoting vocabulary. So glad you got to see that. And yes, if you see me on the street, I'll tell you about Mrs. Soce and I in that film, and my buddy Judy in that film. Daniel writes, A Shot in the Dark, Boys Night Out, Blythe Spirit, Blue Hawaii, and You Belong to Me. All right, I will tell the story. As you know, if you're a longtime listener, I've seen every Elvis film. And Blue Hawaii, there's a great moment. It's just fun casting of Angela Lansbury playing Elvis Presley's mother. She was, I believe, in real life, only nine years older than he was. And anytime I can get my wife to look up from her laptop, I've done something. Just to, you know, get her a break from working. And Angela comes on, and she's kind of the flustered Big Mama type character. And she stops and watches the one scene with Angela. And as soon as she leaves the screen, goes back to her laptop and says, even she can't make that crap sound good. So, speak of the angel, my buddy Judy writes, no movies this week, watched Afterlife on Netflix. Well, now you have to rewatch Diner because we were talking about it, Jude. Beth. Missy writes, 1922. Joshua writes, Hustle, really enjoyed it. Craig writes, Rocky Horror Picture Show and War of the Worlds. Kurt writes, Hyde Park on Hudson, followed by a trip to the local hot dog eatery. Yeah, and there's a comment about your cousin, your cute cousin, but we're not going there. Allison writes, Old and Fantastic Beasts. Taylor writes, Downton Abbey. Amy writes, The Attic's Wake. Stephanie writes, The Offer and Episode 4 of Kenobi. Kaylin writes, Simply Irresistible, Inside Out, Out to Sea, Bye Bye Love, and Ghostbusters Afterlife. Bob Bloom writes, Jurassic World. Jeff writes, White Chicks. Oof. Erica writes, The Sting, The Riff Tracks Treatment of The Power, The Mystery Science Theater Treatment of El Santo in the Wax Museum. With six, you get Egg Roll. No riffing. Planet of the Vampires. God Forgives, I Don't, the first Bud Spencer, Terrence Hill teamings, and McCloud Goes Hawaiian. Okay, that wasn't a real title and it wasn't a movie. No, but Gidget Goes Hawaiian was a real movie. Thank you, Chief. Robert writes, A Foreign Affair, Five Graves to Cairo, Billy, How Did You Do It, Meet Me in St. Louis, or St. Louis, Anything Goes, Before Midnight, RRR, and Fire Music. Linda writes, Maverick, hated it. I assume she means Top Gun Maverick, not the James Garner or series or the Mel Gibson film version of said series. Linda also writes, Belfast again, and then follows it up with The Hideous New Cyrano. All right, the new Cyrano's not hideous, and you could put these in one post, unless you keep forgetting. Sarah writes, Monsters, Inc., Eric writes in his rewatches, Jaws with a couple of good friends, Double Indemnity, and 48 Hours. And I just picked up Double Indemnity on Criterion Blu-ray. Looking forward to that. Plus Judd Apatow's must-see documentary, George Carlin's American Dream, which I got to get on that. Let's see. David writes, 42, Lady Bird, and The Departed. Cassandra writes, Winter Soldier. Michael writes, The World Is Not Enough and Resistance. Nikki writes, Control with Ray Liotta and Willem Dafoe from 2004, and she deemed it interesting. Stephen writes in all caps, The English Patient. Bill writes The Facts of Life with Lucille Ball and Bob Hope. The Postman Always Rings Twice, the original with Lana Turner and John Garfield. And I had every intention of watching Apocalypse Now, which I confess to have never having seen, but I ended up watching The Postman Always Rings Twice. That happens. It's all right, Bill. All right, Stephanie. Something about a jazz festival somewhere, Stephanie writes. Kevin writes, Great Expectations. I own it, of course, but I decided to read the book for the first time. Well, good for you, Kevin. That's cool. Glenn writes, Everything Everywhere All at Once. Rob writes, Last Tango in Paris. I'll never look at butter the same way again. Yeah, Maria Schneider will tell you. She knows about that. And if you get a chance, once again, the podcast, You Must Remember This, they're wrapping up Erotic 80s, but they start at the beginning with Last Tango in Paris and Deep Throat and its 70s impact onto the films of the 1980s. So there's that. While I'm plugging Golden Globus Theater this week, they tackle Highlander 3 and all of the Highlander rules and how Highlander 3 does not acknowledge that Highlander 2 happened and all that stuff. So anyway, that's a couple podcasts that I like. Keith writes, the week before last, I love when they catch up on stuff that they forgot to post last week. Firestarter, The Outfit, which he deemed excellent, Sweet Home Alabama, Grand Prix, Casablanca, 9 to 5, Turbo, The Croods, Once Upon a Crime, and Mayor Cupcake. David writes, Belfast, The Blues Brothers, and The Batman. Tom writes the original Top Gun and The Paper Chase, stepdaughter entering her third year of law school. Just make sure she looks out for Liberty Bell. Ron writes the documentary called The Tower. Brian writes, it's a week late, but I watched RRR, a three-hour Indian action epic. It's a ride. David writes Downton Abbey, Top Gun Maverick, and we will see Jurassic Park Dominion Tuesday and Bob's Burgers movie hopefully Saturday or Sunday. Well, then write it to me after you've seen it, because there's lots of things I want to see, but doesn't necessarily mean I'm going to write and watch it. So only let me know what you have seen, and then the following week when you've seen it, submit. There you go. Thank you, David. Abby writes Top Gun. Jason writes Harriet. Mike writes Good Night and Good Luck. Seems appropriate for the time. Jennifer writes, Love Actually, because I had to erase Mr. Darcy, Colin Firth from The Staircase from my mind. Okay, whatever it takes. As well as Four Weddings and a Funeral. Scott writes Jaws. Another Scott writes Top Gun. First one. Kevin writes Paris, Texas, Nebraska, Crazy Heart, and A Serious Man. That's a series. Megan writes Downton Abbey. Rachel writes Thor and Young Sherlock Holmes. Cindy writes Hustle, Adam Sandler's new movie on Netflix. It was terrific. And finally, Aggie writes Norma Rae. And that's what you've been watching, friends. So hopefully you've got some ideas, some inspiration. I know somebody mentioned Double Indemnity, and since I bought it, I might watch that over the weekend. So that's kind of how this works. It means a lot when somebody says, you mentioned a film, so I watched it, or vice versa, you know, all that stuff. And that's why we've been doing this. So thank you for contributing to public radio goodness. Friends, some words to live by.
Silent breed is people!
Zardoz has spoken.
Go see a good movie. You deserve it. There's plenty out there. Let's not forget Indie Film Fest running June 15th through the 26th. 15th through the 19th at the Can-Can Cinema. Online screenings running through the 26th. Go to IndieFilmFest.org for all the information. Next week, we'll talk about Werner Herzog, because I can. And there's a new collection. And who knows what else. That's the beauty of public radio and this show. So thanks for listening, and we'll do this again next week. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. Good afternoon, Fort Myers. Good afternoon, California. Good afternoon, Michigan.
I can't believe you let her watch Manos. Is she scarred for life?
Let's put it this way.
What parent are you?
When I wake her up, I vocalize the theme to wake her up to get her ready to school.
Oh, you're a terrible father.
Okay. We'll do it live.
Okay.
We'll do it live!